Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Here's the podcast for Live the Promise. Enjoy the conversation. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So glad you tuned in, and welcome to the weekend edition of Live the Promise. Hope you're having a great weekend. Well, here's a question for you. What if Christianity was actually a picture of reality instead of just another private religious view? I mean, what if the Bible is actually true? Obviously, we believe that it is. But do you know how often as Christians, even as Christians, we sometimes live like atheists? Think about that. When we trust Him for our eternity, but we don't trust Him in our everyday life. And then you've got non-believers or people who would identify as atheists. What if we understood Scripture enough that we could reach our atheist loved ones with a compelling view of Scripture? Well, my guest today is author Greg Kuchel. He joins me to talk about his book, The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. This is an important conversation. We'll get to it in just a moment. We've got a couple quick announcements for you. Super excited that Max Lucado's got another great book releasing in September. And what I'm even more excited about is that you can win it here before you can get it on the shelf at the store. So the book releases mid-September, but all this month we are giving away three copies every single day of Max's new book, Anxious for Nothing. And if we've ever been a time when lots of people are battling fears and anxieties, I would say it is right now. So whether you are that person or you love someone who is, I would not waste another moment. Hop on our website, myfaithradio.com. Right on the landing page, you'll see the banner that talks about how to sign up to win Max's new book. Again, it's titled Anxious for Nothing. We're giving away three copies a day. I pray that you are somebody who wins. Go to myfaithradio.com and check it out. Also, just so excited and grateful for the growth that's taking place at Faith Radio. And we ask God, do more through us. Do more through us. Use us, Lord, and take our offering and multiply it. And He's actually doing that. And so we give thanks to Him, but we also give thanks to you because we are a listener-supported ministry. We couldn't even do what we do without your gifts, without your sacrifice, without your prayers. And I want you just to think about this. This offering is going out all over the world. We've got people who live stream with our Faith Radio app and are listening from all kinds of places in the remotest parts of the earth. And we just give God great thanks. But I want to say thank you to you for your friendship, for your support, because we are just getting started. So would you be praying with us as we seek God for the days ahead? Greater things are yet to be done in the city. All right, let me tell you about my guest, and we'll get him on the show. Greg Kuchel holds master's degrees in both apologetics and philosophy. He's spoken on over 70 university campuses, hosted his own radio talk show for 27 years, defending Christianity worth thinking about. He's the founder and president of Stand to Reason and serves as adjunct professor of Christian apologetics at Biola University. And so honored to meet you, Greg. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, Susie, it's a treat to be on the show, and thank you for the promotion, by the way. I'm not really a doctor. I'm a master twice, but it sounds good.
You know what? I think it's prophetic. I mean, that might be your next step. So.
Well, I don't have many years left to get a doctorate. I got my hands full with what I've got already.
Well, we're so honored to have you. My mistake. Sorry about that. Well, we love to talk scripture as soon as we open up the show, and you chose 2 Corinthians 4:16-18. And I just spoke on this passage this past week, and I love it so much. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we're wasting away, inwardly we're renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Man, I love that passage. Talk to us about it, if you would.
Well, that happens to be my favorite passage. For the last few years, at least, I have cited that so often. It is the weight of glory passage that, of course, C.S. Lewis wrote a whole essay on. And I love that passage because, as Jesus said, in this world you have tribulation. And I think when Christians get beset by the troubles that are our natural lot, that we sometimes get caught by surprise because we don't realize down deep in our bones that we are aliens in a strange land, and therefore we are going to have to deal with the all the contingencies of a fallen world that everybody else has to deal with, plus the fact that we're strangers here, we're aliens, we're in a sense behind enemy lines. Things are going to be a lot tougher on Christians than on non-Christians, and this is why we've got to get our picture of reality straight so that we can live properly and confidently in this world as we are preparing for an eternal friendship with God, living close with Him. And I love that passage because I cite it frequently just in my own encouragement. Mm. We do not lose heart. And this is really at the in a certain sense, though I don't cite this in the book, The Story of Reality, it's really a huge part of the reason that I wrote this book, to help Christians get the big picture and to realize that we are not just in a temporal enterprise here in our 4 score and 10, but we are marching to the tune of a different drummer. We understand the way the world really is, reality, and we are setting our goals in light of God's perspectives and expectations and not just our own.
Boy, Greg, I love that you started with that. Again, I was just talking about this weekend, that we've done ourselves such a disservice to preach a quote-unquote gospel that appeals to the consumer mentality in others, as if God's wringing his hands, offering all these different things if you'll just come to him, and not realizing while we were dead in our sins, he died for us. And when you appeal to the consumer mentality, people start to automatically assume this is supposed to be our best life now. And it just, we have to understand that we're not only behind enemy lines, but there's a future glory that far outweighs the trials. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm chomping at the bit here because I love what you're saying there. I am so concerned about this consumer mentality because once you pursue that avenue with a church or in the way we engage other people, this is the tail wagging the dog, Susie. We are putting ourselves at the center of the enterprise. We are saying that the story, the big story of reality, is about us. And any Christian who approaches it that way is going to be deeply and profoundly discouraged in their life. This is the lie the devil said right at the very beginning, trying to tell Adam and Eve this is all about them and not about God. It's as I like to put it, and it's a little twist in an old phrase, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but it's not really about God's wonderful plan for our lives. Rather, it is about our lives for God's wonderful plan. Mm. And I think that's what Paul was getting at in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, that verse you were talking about earlier.
Fantastic. I'd love to hear, Greg, a little bit about your backstory and your faith journey, if you wouldn't mind sharing some with us.
No, that's quite all right. I became a follower of Christ in 1973 when I was a student at UCLA. I was 23 years old at the time. I was raised in kind of a Christian denomination, but it was just pew sitting. That's all it was for us. You know, we're kind of going through the motions. And when everybody grew up in our family, we had 5 kids. We all went our separate ways, and including me. And I embraced the whole countercultural issue of the 60s and all the kind of crazy spiritual but not religious kind of offerings that were available then. And I really wanted to do my own thing, which was the spirit of the age of the 60s, and it's now deeply entrenched nowadays. And it wasn't until my younger brother, Mark, became a follower of Christ as a result of the Jesus movement that he, over time, prevailed on me with the gospel, and the Lord got a hold of me and brought me to himself. And I've been walking with the Lord now 43 years, and you know, the irony for me is that I thought I was too smart to be a Christian, and now I've given my life for a defense for the Christian faith. And I think, simply put, the smart money is on Jesus of Nazareth. Mm. And so for the last 24 years and 1 week today, I think, 24 years and a week today, we started Stand to Reason, and our goal is to train Christians to think more carefully about their convictions and also to be able to engage in a thoughtful, gracious, winsome, attractive, but effective way with those who don't share their convictions. So their conversations look more like diplomacy than like D-Day, I guess, is the way we like to put it. And so that's what I've been involved in, and I've got a couple other books behind me that have been pretty well received, a relativism book that I wrote with Dr. Frank Beckwith about 20 years ago, and then Tactics about 9 years ago, and that's been really, really doing well. I'm so happy because it trains Christians how to engage with a game plan for discussing their convictions. And then just this year, in January, the latest book was released, The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Sounds like a lot, but the key word there is important. And so it's not a book on world history. Rather, under 200 pages, I was able to, I think, present a big picture view of the Christian worldview, and I'm really excited about this book.
You really should be excited about it. You did a fantastic job, and I think you completely encapsulated what we need to know as we stand for our faith. And on the other side, I want to dig into the content a bit more. Just a quick question before we break here. Wondering, do you anticipate another Jesus movement, you know, like we saw in the 70s? Do you, I mean, lots of people are praying for revival, especially in this day. What do you sense?
Well, I have found in my own life that making prognostications is a dangerous thing. You know, my pastor was talking yesterday at service in the sermon about Matthew 24 and about the second coming of Christ and this, that, and the other thing. But he focused in really on a section of that Olivet Discourse where Jesus said, be ready, you know, be on the alert. You don't know when your master's coming, but be a faithful servant in the midst of your waiting. And so when I think about, you know, what is the Holy Spirit going to do in the world in the next 10, 15, 20 years, I think, I don't know, but I have my marching orders, and I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try, by God's grace, to be busy doing the job that I need to do.
Very good. Very good. Talking to Gregory Kokel, author of the book, The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Excellent book. Email me if you want in on the drawing. We've got five copies to get into your hands. Susie, I almost gave you the phone number. Susie@myfaithradio.com. Susie@myfaithradio.com. When we come back, Gregory, we talk about how you can't be a cherry picker. You can't say, I'm a little bit of this and a little bit of that in regard to religions. It doesn't work. And he'll explain why that is when we come back. Back in a minute. Having a great day today. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Greg Kokel. He's authored the book, The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Got five copies. I'd love to get one into your hands. Go in the drawing by just emailing me, Susie, that's spelled S-U-S-I-E, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Please remember your mailing address. So I loved, Greg, your puzzle analogy and how pieces from different puzzles can no more be mixed with other puzzles than pieces of different religions can be mixed together. And yet you hear people kind of tout this idea all the time. I'm a little of this, I'm a little of that. But you say that if they actually understood the pieces to each of these different religions, they would actually realize they are not even intended to go together. Say more if you would.
Right. Yeah, that's right. The problem is people tend to look at the religion project people in our country, in the West in general, as a kind of spiritual fantasy club. That is, they won't say that a religion is false, because that would be impolite, maybe even considered intolerant, but they won't say it's true either in any deep sense. In other words, it's not true in the way gravity is true. It's not true to reality. And see, this is something we have to push against all the time when we're explaining Christianity. Because as I put it in the book, Christianity is a picture of reality that's made up of pieces, like a picture puzzle, just like you pointed out there. That is, we are not trying to assemble something we like, but we're trying to figure out the way the world actually is. And when Jesus came on the scene, he gave a picture of the world, which was really the same picture as the ancient Hebrew prophets. That was the way the world actually was. That's the way it was meant to be understood. Now, if you have the idea that religion is just a matter of assembling ideas that you like, and you just make up your own fantasy. Well, of course, you can do anything you want. You can have all kinds of things in there that are contradictory, that don't fit together in a coherent way, and still feel good about it, right? But if you're really looking for what's true about the world, you need to understand that religions are meant to be taken as a whole as pictures of the way the world is. So Jesus gives a picture of that, and there are certain details to that picture that are really, really important. If you like Eastern religion, for example, and you like, say, reincarnation, if people like that, you can say, I'm a Christian and I believe in reincarnation. But what you don't realize is that that particular puzzle piece does not fit into our puzzle. It doesn't do any work for us. That is, it's kind of like putting a carburetor on a computer, you know, it doesn't fit. And what I want people to see is that when it comes to the so-called religious project, the most important thing is for us to get it right, to get reality right. And unless we take Jesus at his word, that is, he's trying to explain reality, we're going to make a mess of things, okay? So I guess any listener's got to decide, do you want to know what the world is actually like? Or do you want to tell yourself a fantasy that makes you feel good for the moment, but isn't going to do anything for you ultimately? It's like a placebo. It's like Marx said, Karl Marx, that the religion is the opiate of the people. That's one view. I don't think that's what Jesus had in mind. That certainly isn't what we are offering. And if people want to take reality seriously, then they've got to try to form a worldview, or at least embrace a worldview that makes sense of the world as we actually find it and fits together coherently. And this is what I argue in the story of reality, that Christianity is the best explanation for the world as we actually find it. And this is one of the reasons I think Jesus got it right. And if Jesus got it right, then sooner or later everyone is going to face that fact. And I hope they face it sooner than later, because if they face it later, it's going to be too late.
Wow. You say that universities often teach the mindset that there's nothing that you can actually know for certain, and then you further write this. This view is absolutely false. There are lots of things we know, and we know that we know them. Reality has a way of getting our attention and teaching us about itself. This is amazingly simple to demonstrate. Boy, I love that. Say more.
Mm-hmm. Well, it strikes me as massive irony that we send our kids to the university and we spend lots and lots of money and go into debt so that our kids can learn that there's nothing to know.
Yeah.
I mean, I want my money back, you know, that kind of thing. No, the fact is we can know many things. Look, I dialed a number to connect myself with your studio so that we can have this radio conversation together. I had on my schedule that we were going to have a broadcast today. Now, those are claims about reality that I was able to test out. I dialed that number. I got your board op. Now I'm talking to you. So I tested the claim or the belief against reality, and I got enough feedback to know that my belief about reality, as far as it touched those issues, was actually true. Now, we do this every single day, all the time, with small issues and with really big, important issues, issues on which our life depend. So why would anybody be tempted to think that we can't know truth, when in fact we are learning truth all the time? Indeed, if we couldn't know true things about the world, at least some true things, we would be dead in a day. So if we do have some tools available to us that we use all the time to test reality, and we do find out true things about the world, this tells us two things. One, that we can know truth, at least some truth. And secondly, that we have some tools that are reliable for us to accomplish that task. Why can't we put those same tools to work when it comes to spiritual questions? I think we can, and I think we can get reliable answers.
Right.
So there's no reason for us to fall for this idea that we can't know truth. Indeed, the statement itself is a claim to know some truth, that we can't know truth, so it turns out to be self-refuting on the face of it. Yet this is what people fall for all the time, Susie.
And they turn into talking points. You hear them long enough, they almost sound bulletproof until somebody who's given some thought to this has answers for them, and that's why we need answers, right?
That's right. You know, it's amazing when you listen to people who promote these ideas. The students are taking notes, right? I wonder if this is going to be on the test. They're taking notes because they think that the professor is telling them something worthwhile, accurate, and true. But they it never occurs to them that the notion that there is no truth is just simply self-refuting. The fact that they're taking notes about it shows that they don't believe it's true on a deep sense, but they're falling for it on a shallow sense. So this is one of those things that's out there that if we're thoughtful, if we're careful, it becomes immediately obvious that this is not a reliable piece of information. And it's dangerous, too, because it's like saying there are no germs, and then you invite people to dine in a dump, you know. Well, there are germs, and you can get sick. And by the same token, if you say there is no truth, well, it turns out there is truth and falsehood can kill. And then people are not properly equipped to be able to determine what is good and what is bad, what is true and what is false, what is dangerous and what is safe.
It is fascinating. We've probably got a minute and a half before our hard break at the bottom, so we can sure carry this over the other side. But there are just intrinsic laws that we just adapt to on Earth. You know, the law of gravity, the law if I eat too much, I'll gain weight. If I don't get enough sleep, I'm going to get sick. If a farmer doesn't plant his seeds, he won't have a harvest. I mean, they're just everywhere you turn. We abide by laws, whether we like it or not, and we affirm that they're true because we're abiding by them. So how do we play such dangerous games with things like our eternity and whether or not there's one true God? We feel so at liberty to mess around with that one without really grappling with it, you know?
Well, you know, if a lie is repeated often enough and persuasively enough with a lot of rhetorical flair and a lot of attitude, then people begin believing it. And this is one of them, you know, that we can't know. Oh, maybe we can know scientific truth, but we can't know anything that touches on the spiritual realm. It's just out of our area of knowledge. And this is an Enlightenment notion that a lot of people have bought. But there's a whole host of reasons why that we shouldn't believe that. There are a lot of things that we know about the world. Look at when people complain about the problem of evil. Just think about this: the number one complaint that people have about life, when it comes to religion, is the problem of evil. Now, this means they are perceiving moral brokenness in the world. Do you realize that moral brokenness is not something you can sense with your five senses? You can see events happen with your five senses, so you can be aware, but you're making a moral judgment on them, not based on five senses. Now, I think there is something wrong with the world. Everybody knows that. But do you realize that that is not something that science can deliver to you? No, we are seeing something with a faculty that we have for knowing something in the invisible realm.
Let's pause.
That is reliable.
Let's pause here. Talking to Gregory Kokol. When we come back, we'll finish this conversation. Fantastic. Back in a minute. Tuning in today, I'm Susie Larson. This is The Promise, talking to Gregory Kokol. So honored to talk with him. He's got a great book titled The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Have you ever heard of a more important book title? We've got 5 copies. You want in on the drawing, just email me, Susie, and others have asked me to spell my name, S-U-S-I-E, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Love this, Greg. You're right. Confused talking leads to confused thinking. Some beliefs are true, others are not. And the difference matters. If a story is not accurate to reality, it's not any kind of truth at all. So it can never be my truth or your truth, even though we may believe it. It can only be our delusion, our mistake, or our error. Say more if you would.
Well, this is touching on a very popular way of talking about things nowadays. When you get into the realm of spiritual truth, people or moral truth, people just say, well, that's your truth. He has his truth, and I have my truth, and we all have our own truth. Well, this is, as I point out in the book, this is a very confused way of talking, because what we're describing here is beliefs, and beliefs are either true or false. if our beliefs are not true, then it's not any kind of truth, as I pointed out. And if we stick to that way of talking about things, Susie, then we are essentially stonewalled as to moving forward to finding out what the world is actually like, especially in spiritual things. If we just think it's all a matter of our own truths, then that's as far as we can go, and there's no conversation anymore. It's totally subjective. The point I was making before the break is, the fact is we can know things about the invisible realm, and we discover those things every single day. And one very handy example of that is that people complain about the problem of evil, understandably so, not only in their own lives, but as it touches religious claims about the world. How can God exist if there's so much evil in the world? I just want to point out that the only way anybody could raise that issue is if they know there is evil in the world. But this is not something they know through science. They know this through a different faculty. Now, I think they're right about this. I think there is evil in the world, and there's good in the world as well. But what this is meant to demonstrate is that we do have faculties that allow us to get at these issues, issues of the invisible realm, if you will, with some kind of reliability. And those are things we can press into service for the larger religious questions about the existence of God and the reliability of Jesus as a person speaking with authority about spiritual matters, etc. And these are some of the things I try to point out in the book. There are some clues about the way the world is that we can figure out on our own. Other things the author has to tell us. And when we combine those two things together, using the biblical story as a source material, we come up with a profoundly engaging account of reality that resonates with our deepest intuitions about the way the world is. And it answers our questions, and it also provides a solution.
You know, Scripture talks, Greg, about men being darkened in their understanding due to the hardening of their hearts. Do you feel like this is in part what we're seeing today, that some just really actually don't want to know the truth because their hearts have gone hard and they don't want to know?
Well, there's no question about that in my mind, and that has always been the case. Every period of history, there are new clever ways of manifesting that, and so we see this relativistic impulse that we've been talking about. As a current example of people finding a way to ignore what's obvious, okay? I'll give you one example of this. I've already talked about the problem of evil, that the world is not the way it's supposed to be. But if the world is not the way it is supposed to be, problem of evil, that means there must be a way the world is supposed to be, and you can't have a way the world is supposed to be without a exposer, so to speak. There's got to be a purpose for the world if things are not right. If there is no purpose for the world, you can't say that things aren't right. You can't say they are right or aren't. They just are, okay? But we have this deep intuition that things aren't right, which then ought to inform us that a strictly atheistic, materialistic view of the world is not adequate to make sense of the world that we find, okay? Because it can't make sense of a world filled with purpose that is not being fulfilled, which is what the problem of evil amounts to, okay? The Christian story of reality can do that. And that's one of the reasons I find it so compelling, because it touches on these most profound issues that we all think about at some time or other in life. But as I mentioned earlier, it answers those issues in a way that resonates with our deepest intuitions about reality. It doesn't deny the problem of evil like materialism, atheism has to. It faces it square and head on, explains the problem, where it came from, and then gives us a powerful solution to that problem. Partly because we realize when we think about the problem of evil, it's not just out there in the abstract. The problem of evil is tied to human beings and what human beings do to each other, not just that bad guy down the street or on the news, but also each person who thinks about this realizes there's evil in their own lives. And, of course, the Bible, the Christian story, speaks very candidly about this.
In your book, you talk about two obstacles that prevent unbelievers from truly buying into the Christian faith. What are they? It's been a while since you wrote the book, isn't it?
Embarrassing to ask an author.
Hey, been there myself. I totally get it.
Help me out here.
Two obstacles. Wait, let's see here. I found it. Hold on. I found it. Here it is. They fail to understand their own story. They're not able to understand the two objections most frequently raised. I guess one was about evil,
yeah.
Right? And the other.
Right,
yes.
Right. See, oh, okay. Now I know what you're getting at. If followers of Jesus do not get their story right, if they don't get the big picture, they are going to be confounded by the two biggest problems that they're going to face as believers. That is the biggest objections against their view. And that is, I've already mentioned, the problem of evil. And secondly, why Jesus is the only way. I mean, this is wildly politically incorrect nowadays. But what people don't understand, especially Christians, this is their story. What they don't understand is that the problem of evil is not the problem that most people think it is for the Christian story. Our entire story is about the problem of evil. It starts in the third chapter, and it ends 66 books later, and we're in the middle of our story. This is all getting worked out, okay? So the problem of evil is not foreign to our story, so we should not be surprised that people complain about the problem of evil. We can deal with that. Secondly, though, singular problems often have singular solutions, and so we have a serious problem of evil that touches on human behavior, human guilt, okay, human rebellion, and we have a singular solution in Jesus who does something no one else can do. He solves the problem. And the reason that Jesus is the only way, and I go into a lot of detail in the book, of course, explaining this, but the simple answer is the reason Jesus is the only way of salvation is he's the only one who solved the problem, okay? And so we can make sense of this challenge against us if we understand the big picture. And this is something I step people through in a very conversational, accessible way, try to take these deeper concepts, but throw the ball so people can catch it, so to speak, in a very kind of narrative style, lay the details out so people can see how both of these things nestle nicely into the Christian story of reality, giving credibility to the story itself, I think, that it really is the story of reality, but also helping us to respond to these challenges that people offer us.
You know, it's so interesting, and I don't know if I'll regret saying this later, but I mean, I believe stats back this up, that Christians are some of the most generous people on the planet, tending to some of the greatest needs in the world today. And at times when hear atheists address the issue of the problem of evil, that sounds so caring. What about the problem of evil? But what do they solve then by getting rid of God from their quote-unquote theology?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I do address this in the beginning of the book. Some people can't believe in God because of the problem of evil, all right? I get it. I understand that. But I have a question. The question is, now that they've gotten rid of God from the picture, what are they going to do about the problem of evil? Because the problem of evil hasn't gone away. The problem is still there. What has gone away is one potential way of solving the problem, that is an understanding of how God fits into the picture. Okay, so you don't believe in God. Now what? And see, this is something that never gets addressed. The problem of evil is not a Christian problem. It is not a theistic problem. It is a human problem. Therefore, every single human being, regardless of what theology or philosophy that they happen to adopt, whatever worldview, whatever picture of reality they think is true, still has to answer that problem, the problem of evil. How are they going to do it? The materialist has no resources to answer the problem of evil. In fact, they can't even make sense of it. And I remember a famous quote by British philosopher Bertrand Russell, 20th century atheistic British philosopher, now gone. But he said, how can you talk about God when you're kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Wow, that has rhetorical force. And I was a bit stymied as to how to respond to that until I heard Christian philosopher William Lane Craig's response. He said, what is the atheist Bertrand Russell going to say when he's kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Tough luck? That's the way it goes.
Wow.
See, atheism gives them nothing to respond to this. Only a tortured silence, that's all that's available to them. But the Christian has much they can say about about that circumstance. There was a message of hope, in principle at least, that could be offered there, where the atheist can do nothing like that.
Wow. Talking to Greg Kokel today, I love his book titled The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Don't go away. More conversation when we come back. I want you to know we've got 5 copies of this great book. Just really will help equip you to share your faith and to know what you believe and why you believe it from a biblical standpoint. Email me if you'd like in on the drawing, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget that mailing address, and we'll be back in a minute. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Greg Kokel, author of the book The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. And you mentioned in the book, Greg, that you saw a bumper sticker one day that said something like, God is too big to fit into one religion, and to those who think differently, they think too highly of themselves and their own beliefs. Talk for a minute about God and how he fits in the kingdom narrative, the actual story of reality. And yes, go ahead, please.
Well, the bumper sticker is troublesome because it discourages people from coming to conclusions that they can be confident of. That is, if they do, then they have a character flaw. They're too arrogant. They're too narrow-minded. God is too big to fit into one religion. Well, this makes no sense whatsoever, okay? Religions give an account of who God is. If God exists, he's either a personal God or he's not personal. I mean, he can't be both, all right? So there's an exclusive nature to these claims that you can't get around. When you go to the biblical story, the story of reality that Jesus believed, well, there's a certain characterization of God. And the characterization is that God is a personal kind of being, okay? He's someone, he's not just something, and that he made the entire world. Just as an act of will, you know. Now, we actually have some scientific evidence for that. That is Big Bang cosmology. And I know a lot of Christians are uncomfortable with the notion for their own reasons, whatever, but I think partly they don't realize how well it fits into our story. Our story begins, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But the materialistic story, at least the scientific evidence, is that the universe did come into being with a bang at some point in the distant past. How far past is a matter of debate, but it doesn't matter. The universe came into existence. This fits our story wonderfully, okay? But our story tells why it came, because there was a benevolent, perfect being who created it and man in it, so that man could be in friendship with him. And see, this beginning of the story sets the stage for everything that follows. We learn what kind of universe we're in. We're in a universe where there are invisible things and visible things. We learn that we're in a moral universe where there are good things and there are bad things. We learn that we are special in this universe. Human beings are beautiful, made in the image of God. We already know that, by the way. This is why we have laws protecting human beings that are different from protecting other things. Humans are special. At the same time, we know that humans are broken, and we need to be fixed in some measure. Everybody knows that. That's the problem of evil. And so this opening lines of the story, as we read the opening chapters, we get the layout that there is a beginning. We learn the main characters, but then we learn what the problem is, and we learn that very quickly. The rest of the story is about how the problem gets fixed. And if you don't get the problem right, you can't get the fix right either. Those are really, really important factors tied together. And the wonderful way about how this story unfolds is there are touch points, as I mentioned, where scientific evidence has a bearing, or historical evidence has a bearing of showing the truthfulness of the story that we're involved with here. But there are also other touch points that are touch points in a certain sense of the heart, and I don't mean just subjective things. I mean how the story resonates with our deepest intuitions about who we are. We know there's something special about human beings, but why are we special? The atheistic worldview makes no sense of that. This story tells us why we know we're special, because we're made in the image of God. It also tells us what's wrong. We rebelled against that friendship. We betrayed our sovereign, and now we're in a massive battle. And we are desperately fallen and broken and enslaved, and we need to be rescued. And so that's how the story kind of rolls out, and then God explains what that rescue looks like.
Hmm. You even say that hardly any scientists or physicists actually believe that the universe just always existed. They do believe the universe actually had a beginning. Now, you touched on that, but say a bit more about that, because maybe friends listening today didn't realize that.
Well, you know, it's pretty common acceptance right now in the scientific realm. Very, very few people accept that the universe is eternal, and there's a lot of good scientific reasons to reject that notion. But what's ironic is for the last 100 years, the 20th century, the record of science and cosmology was pushing against the idea that the universe had a beginning because they knew the theological ramifications.
Hmm.
If it had a beginning, it must have had a beginner, and they didn't want to go there. This is kind of the hard-headedness and the rebellion we talked about earlier. And so they tried to find all kinds of ways to get out from underneath that. I mean, Einstein even cheated in his math to try to avoid the implications of what he was discovering, what astronomers were discovering. Now they've settled in as a matter of established fact that the universe had a beginning. Well, that fits our story absolutely, perfectly, hand in glove. Now, what do? You have one of two choices. You could say that nothing caused the universe to come into existence. That means there was no cause. Or you could say that something caused it. If you say something caused it, well, that's going to have to be something powerful, smart, outside of time, outside of space, outside of the natural order. You're getting pretty close to the God thing right now. The only other alternative is to say that the universe popped into existence for no reason, out of nothing, and, I mean, let's be honest, that's worse than magic. At very best, it's not the odds-on favorite. So right from the very beginning of the scientific enterprise, the foundational thing in cosmology, we've got all the evidence on our side here. People have to do something wildly counterintuitive to get beyond it, and that is to say the universe came from nothing, which some people are trying to say. But like I said, that's not where the smart money is. I'm going to stick with the smart money.
Hmm.
God created the heavens and the earth.
And how about this common question? Well, then who created God?
Well, you know, when somebody says, famously, you know, have you stopped beating your wife? Okay, this presumes something. It presumes that you were beating, and maybe you stopped and maybe you didn't. This is called a complex question. When somebody says, who created God, this presumes that God was created. Now you ask, who did it? I was in a national debate with Michael Shermer, the founder of Skeptic Magazine, atheist, and he asked that question of me. And I said, Michael, you don't believe God was created because you don't believe in God. I don't believe God was created because I think God is an eternal being. Nobody in our conversation believes that God was created. So why are you asking who created him? Okay.
That's fantastic.
So there was a little rhetoric going on there, but it makes the point fairly quickly. It's not an appropriate question to ask of a being that is eternal. Our view isn't everything needs a creator. Our view is only that the universe came into existence. Everybody believes that. So now the question is, what is the best explanation? The best explanation is a self-existent divine being who caused the universe to come into existence. There is nothing troublesome or difficult or incoherent about that notion. And therefore, we don't need to answer the question, who created God, because we don't think God was a created being. No difficulty there.
Yeah. I would love to be as smart as you are, Greg. Just for
a day. That's pretty sweet. But what I'm trying to do is take these concepts and make them accessible.
Indeed.
So you know, because you read the book, people who read the book will have access to these.
Yeah.
And I think in a very straightforward way. They're not complicated. Like I said, I try to throw the ball so people can catch it.
You definitely, definitely accomplished that. That's for sure. Well, we've got about 2.5 minutes left, Greg, and not nearly enough time to talk about the resurrection. But I want to wrap with just the idea of the resurrection and of the hope that is to come. Would you speak to that, if you would?
Sure. This is where I think history intersects our own convictions, all right? I have a chapter in there in the book called Four Facts, and I look at four individual facts that virtually every historian on the life of Jesus affirms to be true. And I'm saying the very vast majority of them, not Christians, doesn't matter what their theological stripe. And here are those minimal facts: that Jesus was crucified and died at a Roman cross, that 3 days later the tomb he was laid in was empty, that there were appearances to, or I should say the disciples claimed they saw Jesus, and then they risked their lives for that testimony. And finally, there were skeptics like James and Saul of Tarsus that were completely converted based on what they saw, they thought was an appearance of Jesus. Now, none of these facts have any supernatural elements. You have a dead man, you have an empty tomb, you have claims of disciples and skeptics that they saw something. That's it. If you work with those four facts, the question that we're faced with is, what best explains those facts? And I go into some detail in the book, not too hard, but pretty straightforward stuff, that the only explanation that is going to satisfy all of those facts that historians agree on is the explanation the disciples themselves gave, that he who is dead is now alive. They didn't hallucinate this. There aren't no such things as group hallucinations, not like this. Not multiple times in many different places. The tomb was empty for a good reason, not because the disciples stole the body. They had no interest in doing that. They would know that their claims that Jesus was resurrected was a lie, and they'd be giving their lives for a lie they knew to be a lie. Who does that? The Jews didn't want to steal the body. The Romans didn't want to steal the body. Jesus was dead, no question about that. He was half embalmed, for goodness sake, with 75 pounds of herbs and spices. No, there's no other explanation, given the historical facts that virtually everybody agrees on, that is going to be adequate, save the resurrection of Christ. And if Jesus rose from the dead, wow, that changes everything.
Boy, and you even think about the idea that the two Marys going to the tomb, you know, that Jesus met with them. They would write a different story in that day if they were making it up. They wouldn't have led
with
that.
Well, that's right, because witness testimony, the men were hiding, shivering, shaking. It was the women who had the first encounter. Anybody making a story up is not going to make the story up that way.
Indeed. Well, Greg, this has been fantastic. I pray you'll come back and visit us again. And as we wrap, I'm wondering if you'd pray for that person listening today who longs to better able to articulate their faith. Would you pray for that person?
Yes. Dear Lord, thank you for this great time with Susie and the rest of the audience. And Lord, I ask that the things that we've talked about will stimulate people to think more carefully about you. And for those that are followers of you that are uncertain, Lord, that they would be encouraged and pick up the book and be more encouraged about the truth of the story of reality. For those who don't know you, we pray, Father, that they will see by your Spirit that the really smart money is on your Son, Jesus of Nazareth, that you graciously reached into history, became a man to rescue us because we desperately needed you. Do that for us, we ask in Jesus' name.
Amen. Thanks for joining us today, Greg. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, it went like a bullet.
I know.
I enjoyed it as well.
Very, very good.
I look forward to next time.
Yeah, I do too as well. Just so you know, friends, we've had so many of those who've endorsed his book. Lee Strobel, Rick Warren, Johnny Erickson Tada, J. Warner Wallace all say this is a fantastic book. I agree. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. You can find a podcast of this program up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Be sure to share this conversation with a friend who would be strengthened by it today. You can do that by clicking the share button under the audio link. Take some time to browse our website as well for new articles and content about growing in your faith in Jesus Christ. Finally, guess what? The Lord wants you to last long and finish strong. He's the one who'll keep you strong to the end. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Live the Promise. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend. Help grow the impact of the show. Also, if you would, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player, and then never miss a show.